Good evening. You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm your host this week, Emily Guerin. Today, we'll be hearing from a number of talented storytellers from the North Fork Valley. They gathered at the Blue Sage in Paonia last Wednesday to tell true tales about guts. Our first story comes from Barry Smith. Barry is a writer and performer living in Paonia. He writes a weekly humor column for the Aspen Times, and his multimedia comedy, Jesus in Montana, won Outstanding Solo Show at the New York International Fringe Festival.
The first time I realized that things didn't always work out the way you want them to was when I was 10 years old. I was in my room, and I heard the phone ring, and a few moments later, I heard my mother scream. And I ran to the next room to see what was going on, and I found my mother sitting on the floor next to the phone, and she had her face down in her hands, and she was stomping her feet, and she was just howling and sobbing and screaming and stomping, no, 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 no. And I had never seen anyone in such a state before, let alone my mother. And turns out the phone call was to tell her that her father had just died suddenly of a heart attack. She was the youngest, five kids, close southern family. You know, she was a daddy's girl. It was devastating. She was devastated right in front of me. I'd never seen a human being devastated before, and I thought, man, I sure would like to avoid that. I grew up in the very, very deep south, like the deepest of deep south. If you imagine the deep south, it's a little bit further south of that, culturally, if not geographically. It wasn't necessarily a dangerous place I grew up in, but it kind of was dangerous, but it was dangerous. It was an avoidable sort of danger that we tend to have brought upon ourselves for no real reason. A lot of poisonous snakes in the deep south, water moccasins, copperheads, rattlesnakes, and not just out there, but like, you know, at your doorstep. And rather than being taught to avoid snakes altogether, I was just taught to identify the ones that may kill you from the ones that may not kill you, and was actually encouraged to go and play with snakes, and, you know, go catch some snakes and come home at supper time. Pretty avoidable danger, but for fun, we would go and throw things at each other in the backyard, dirt clods, if we were lucky, rocks, if not. You know, this was the 70s, so it was not only pre-internet, it was pre-video games, so you kind of had to make your own fun, right? I remember one particularly good rock fight. It was me and my brother. He was a little bit younger than me, and I picked up a pretty nice pointy rock that I could get some good velocity on. And he was hiding behind a bush throwing rocks from back there, and I sent it straight through the bush, and it penetrated there, and I heard, ow! And I thought, score. I mean, that's kind of the shot you dream of, right? And then he comes out from behind the bush, and he's clutching his face, and there's blood coming from between his hands, and I, like 1 inch below his eye, I hit him. I was like this close to just destroying his eyeball, but I was home in time for supper, so that's okay. Our family would go swimming in the Mississippi River as a family outing, and if you only know one thing about the Mississippi River, it's that you don't go swimming in it. And we were in Mississippi, so you'd think that would be the sort of thing that was handed down, but I mean, you know, it's a big, scary, wide river, and it, you know, famous people in my own extended family had been sucked into this thing, and they find you in the Gulf of Mexico, if ever. So we would go swim in there. It was kind of hot in the south, so and in the actual water, besides the raging, terrible death current, there were water moccasins. So, you know, poisonous snakes sneaking around there. Water moccasins are the snakes that have never heard that saying that snakes are more afraid of you than you are of them. You know, they will, like, cross the street to come and kill you. snapping turtles, which technically aren't, you know, dangerous or deadly, but I was told that when they snap down on whatever part of you they snap down on, they can lock their jaw, and you can't make them let go, and they won't let go until they hear a thunder. Now, I don't know if that's true, but when I was a kid, I knew that was true. The neighborhood we grew up in was pretty safe, you know, again, relatively. There was a nice little rural neighborhood, not unlike many parts of Paonia. This reminds me a lot of where I grew up. But, there was one kid who moved into town who was kind of a kind of a bad element. He was a little bit younger than me, and I never quite got the story. I think his parents had died. Maybe he was living with his grandparents. He was, you know, very unsupervised, didn't go to school, hung out all day, which, you know, he kind of had a lot of free time to do things in the neighborhood, including break into my house one day. Now, I know it was him that broke into my house because the house was clearly kind of semi, you know, amateurishly ransacked, and the only thing that was missing were my walkie-talkies. So it's like, you know, including my mother's jewelry box that had been open. It's like, no, walkie-talkies in there, moving on. So it was pretty obviously him. He had taken his grandfather's high-powered rifle and fired a shot through the trailer across the street where someone was living, like right through the corner of it. And if you were to go and look, as I did, through the hole that was formed through that trailer, it's like a telescope, and you look through that telescope, and you're looking exactly at his front porch. So I didn't have the encyclopedic knowledge of police procedural television shows that I currently have, but it was pretty easy to forensically point that one out. one day, this kid was riding his bike in the street in front of our house, and I was 13. I was kind of feeling like I needed to do something. I needed to kind of step up and let him know that taking my walkie-talkies ain't cool. And the way I did this is I grabbed a stick from the yard, you know, sticks in the yard. And he saw me and he started speeding up a little bit. And I made it to him just in time to put that stick right in his front spokes. You know? And his velocity was such that he was just, you know, there was a moment there where you didn't quite know. Is he going to land safely back on his rear tire and ride away? Or is he... And he went all the way over, like, face first, right on the cement. Kind of what I was hoping for, you know? And he sprawled out on the cement and you know, picked himself up, and he was crying, and I said, like, let this be a lesson to you, or whatever I said, because I didn't really know how to be manly or protect myself or my family, but I was learning, right? I mean, it seemed like a good step, and I didn't feel that good about seeing this kid cry, but at the same time, I felt like it was my duty to protect. About just a few months after that bicycle stick incident, I got awakened early in the morning by someone who told me that that my mother was just killed in a car accident, and that I would never, ever see her again. But instead of having that reaction that my mother had, and instead of howling and crying and stomping, I just went absolutely numb. And I just felt nothing. Like this incredible emptiness and this hollowness. And all the adults after a funeral were saying, you know, it's okay, Barry, it's okay to cry. And I knew it was okay to cry. I had no problem with crying. I just felt nothing. And later that summer, my brother and I moved out to California. My parents had divorced, and my father lived out there already. And so we went to move out there with him. Now, by this time I was 14, and the accent that I had was just monumental, you know, because the Mississippi Delta, like right where I was, that is the place where the accents that they grow are the accents that people in Arkansas make fun of, right? They're like the accents that make Alabama accents feel good about themselves. Like, well, at least it's not that bad. And that's the accent that I showed up with in Southern California in 1980, where the world was a little less homogenous. There was no Duck Dynasty, right? No one had ever heard the type of words that were about to come out of my mouth, come out of a human being's mouth. And I didn't really know that. I just thought, here I come. And the thing, even now, if you have that Southern accent, there's some people that still think that means you're a little bit stupid. You know, and the thing is, even when you're a kid and somebody thinks you're a little bit stupid, you can tell that they think you're a little bit stupid. I can still tell to this day, in fact. So I would say things, you know, be introduced to my father's coworkers, and they would say, oh, well, welcome to California. How do you like California so far? And I'd say, Oh, that's real neat. I went to Disneyland. It was real neat. And I ate a burrito. Never had a burrito before. That was real neat. And that's really neat people here. And I really like it. It's really neat here. And they would just kind of pat me on the head and think, good luck. And it turns out I needed some good luck because I did not get off to a good foot in Southern California. We moved there, all our stuff got shipped out, moved into a nice little stucco house with lots of other stucco houses in the Southern California suburbs, and lived in the end of a cul-de-sac. I'd never even heard the word cul-de-sac before. Started school. One day my brother and I are out playing in the common area, looking for things to throw at each other, no doubt. And I look down, I see some kids are at, like my age, are in front of my house, and the garage door is open. They're kind of like right up in the garage, like looking around at something. I figure I better go check this out. And I go down there and say, hey, what are y'all doing? Which did not go over well. I don't know why. What else was I supposed to say? And they said, just looking at these boots. And I said, what's wrong with the boots? And they said, no, they're kind of stupid. Now, the boots they were looking at just happened to be my most prized possession in the world, because they were my mother's most prized possession, because what these boots were, they were my grandfather's boots, her father. He was a cotton farmer in Mississippi, you know, a serious hard-working man, had some gnarly old farming boots, and she thought that was the most iconic expression of who he was. And they were, you know, really worn in these beautiful bits of art that reminded her of him, and she had those mounted in this glass cube that were like with these cypress frames. It was very rustic and very, you know, very gothic almost, and really, in retrospect, really kind of creepy and like like sort of like wouldn't look out of place in the Addams Family home, or, you know. But at the time, they were just like, this is my granddaddy's boots, the thing that my mother loved the most, therefore I must protect the bizarre cube of boots. And certainly I have to defend its honor, right? So now here are these kids making fun of the boots. And I said, what's wrong with the boots? And they said, blah, blah, blah. And it kind of became this little 14-year-old pissing match, which is how boys sometimes introduce themselves to each other. And at one point, I even said, my granddaddy died in them boots. No. Which didn't have the effect that I was hoping. It didn't really win their sympathy. They actually thought that was pretty funny. And the one kid said, my grandfather didn't die in a pair of stinking boots. And I said, oh yeah, what'd your granddaddy die in? And he said, no kidding, slacks. So that all kind of dissipated. They went their way, I went my way, didn't think much else of it. Next day at school, the school bus drops me off. I'm walking home from there, and I hear some footsteps approaching me from behind on the street pretty quickly, and just enough that I turned back to see what it was, just in time to see this big Mongo dude running towards me full speed and just clip me in the back, you know, right on the neck, and just knock me face down on the cement. And before I knew it, he starts kicking at me. He's standing over me, just kicking me as hard as he can. And he says, you leave my little brother alone. Not in a Southern accent. Sorry, let me do that again. You leave my little brother alone. And he's kicking me. And I notice he's actually wearing these cowboy boots, which even at the time seems like an interesting detail, because it's, what are you wearing cowboy boots in Southern California? And you've got boots. Seems like your brother would be a little more sympathetic to the existence of boots. But, I didn't have a lot of time to really go into that, because I was being kicked by this giant dude who, like, probably was already voting age, and he was only a freshman in high school. And he's just kicking. And all I could do was just ball up and just, you know, like, I got some body blows, and he got me in the head, and I knew that I was just going to have to lay there until his leg got tired. You know, that was my only recourse. And he kicked me, and he said, farm boy, and he called me names, and his, you know, his started feeling the burn in his quad there, and him and his friends walked away laughing, and that's when I started crying. That's when I had that face in the hands, howling, crying, sobbing, stomping that I had never been able to have until that moment, because somehow it had just gotten stuck in me, and maybe that kicking had lodged out of me, and I was just bawling and howling and laying like really literally in the middle of the street while this was happening, and everyone else had dissipated except the one guy who was kind of my friend. I'd kind of met him, and he was standing there just going like, dude, are you okay? And because, you know, it's, first of all, he just sees me get the shit kicked out of me, and then I'm crying, and a little more than somebody should be crying about that. And you know, the answer was no, I'm not okay. I'm really, really not okay, because I'm in this horrible, truly dangerous place where I'm getting kicked for reasons that I don't understand, and my mother's dead, and nobody knows this about me, and I was just like as deeply lonely as I could ever possibly be. And again, I couldn't explain any of this. I just finished my crying and got up and went home and immediately devised a plan to keep that from happening again. Unfortunately, this kid lived right on the route to the bus stop, so there was really no way to go around his house. It's like I had to go the way he was going. And we lived in a little cul-de-sac, like I said, and there's a little wall there. So I, you know, the first morning I would kind of wait at the wall for him to go, and I could see him, and I'd wait till he was down there a ways, and then I would leave. And I had it timed so that I could basically get to the bus stop as the bus driver was about to close the door, so I didn't have to stand around with the guy for any length of time at all. And this worked well for a survival mechanism for a week or so. And I thought, you know, nobody's got my back. Really, my closest relatives are 2,000 miles away. This is just what I have to do for now. And about the fifth day of that, I was kind of running late for school, so I forgot the fact that I was in mortal danger every minute, and I was thinking about being late for the bus, and I rounded the corner just in time to see him having just walked out of his house, so we're a lot closer than I'm comfortable with. And I stop, and I start walking really slowly, kind of ninja-like, kind of if I shadow each one of his steps, you know, maybe he won't know I'm there. But somehow he did, and he turned around, and he stopped. And he put his hands on his hips, and he looked right at me. And I was stuck, you know. I can't go backwards. I can't turn around and run. I really wanted to turn around and run. I actually wanted to turn around and run so fast that I like went back in time, like in that Superman movie, back to the time when like the only thing that really concerned me was finding the perfect dirt clod to throw at my brother. But going backwards was obviously not an option. And all this time I'm thinking this, my feet never really stopped moving. I wasn't taking real steps, but I was taking little baby steps forward because I wanted to give the illusion that I didn't even notice him there, right? And this is just the way I walk to school, very, very slowly. What's the hurry to get to school after all? And I realized I just had to move forward no matter what. And it wasn't like I was going to take him or that I could take him or any of that. It wasn't that sort of courage. It was just more like a courage of giving in. And not a self-pity giving in, just a serene turning over to whatever is going to happen next. I need to just walk forward into it. And at that point, it was easily the bravest thing I'd ever done. I took a step forward and another step, and I just walked straight towards him. And when we were within earshot, he said, "Hey, remember when I kicked your ass last week?" And I said, "Yeah." "Yeah." And he said, "Sorry about that. I don't know, I was just having a bad day or something. That wasn't cool." And I said, "Oh, that's all right." And I walked up, and we walked the rest of the way, side by side, to the bus stop. And I knew we weren't going to go on to become best buddies. I knew it wasn't going to have like an 80s movie, happy ending, storybook sort of thing. I knew that. But just for that one little moment, I thought maybe for a little while, things are going to be okay. And that was probably the most significant little walk to the bus of my life thus far, and for the life of me, I just cannot remember what we talked about on that way, but I'm pretty sure at some point along the way, I looked over and said, "I like your boots." Thank you.
You've been listening to stories from the North Fork Storytelling Series on Local Motion at KVNF. Up next is Angus Stocking. Angus is a land surveyor, writer, and performer based in Paonia.
So I don't think anyone in this room has heard this story, and the problem with this story is that I come out looking pretty good. Which is like the kiss of death, right? You want to tell a story where you are made to be a fool, or where you're inappropriately angry, or where things go really bad for you. But so this happened in high school. We had a history teacher named Cy Sigala, or of course, Mr. Sigala to us. And Mr. Sigala was a pretty impressive guy. He was a weightlifter, big man, V torso, coached wrestling, handlebar mustache, the works. Held in some respect, a man of few words. He came into our history class one afternoon, angry. And he's the kind of guy, if he's angry, he's got your attention. And he says, yesterday somebody stole $20 from my desk. I didn't see who did it, but I know who did it. And I want that person to confess it right now. And if you do confess it, that'll be the end of it. But if you don't, you're going to suffer the consequences. And he stops, and we're all just staring at him like little lemmings in a cave, you know, just scoping in, and nothing happens. No one volunteers. He says, okay, I didn't want to do this, but I'm going to narrow the class down so that you know that I know who did it, and that person is going to confess this. So he divided the class into two. So if you can imagine, I was sitting over here on the right side of the class, and this class was over here, and said, it's not in this half of the classroom. The person responsible didn't do it. So everyone on my side was immediately relieved because we were innocent. And we looked around at each other and all but high-fived each other because we weren't the guilty half of the classroom. So then he turns his attention to this half. And so somebody in this half of the room is guilty, is going to have, you know, a rain of fire come down on them. But still, nobody puts their hands up to confess to this great sin, this stealing of $20. So he says, okay, didn't want to do this, but I'm going to narrow it down some more. It's a girl. So one of you women here is guilty. And at that point, you know, for some reason, the bell started to go off in my head. I'm over here. I'm in the safe side. Nothing's wrong with me. I'm bulletproof. But it bugged me. It kind of got under my skin because he'd said a couple of things. He'd said that he hadn't seen this person. He didn't really know. He was guessing, I thought. And I was thinking, you know, it's America. We're innocent until we're proven guilty, right? This something just wasn't wrong. Meanwhile, he's continuing with his narrowing down of the field. It's not just a girl in this half of the classroom, it's a girl wearing a jacket. So that gets it down to like three or four people who are obviously terrified. And at that point, I had had enough. And as I'm starting to mutter and say things to him and start to remonstrate, the people around me are shushing me. Are saying, Angus, just let it go. Which I've heard many times since. But at the time was kind of new to me. And I stood up in righteous indignation. I said a few things, which was probably a little babbling. And finally I said, this is and I stormed out of the classroom. And what do you do once you storm out of a high school classroom? I look around. There's no real obvious moves here for me. So I go to the library, which is still where I go when I have to lick my wounds and recover and figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life now that I'm going to get kicked out of high school and become a criminal. So I'm at the library. I get a book, and I open the book, and I look at it. Reading was beyond me, but I could look at a book. So I'm reading or looking at the book, meditating, trying to figure out how I'm going to explain this to my parents, you know, just what's going to happen here. After a bit of this, another friend of mine, a wrestling team member, came to the library, spots me, and comes over to me, and he's looking at me in the oddest way. He's looking at me as if I've just maybe won the lottery, and he's the one that's going to tell me or something. There's a numinous quality to the moment, which I don't understand. And he says, come on back. So I get back to the classroom, and everyone in the classroom is looking at me with awe and pleasure, which is a feeling I've been wanting to have ever since. And come to find out that this teacher, Mr. Sigala, had been seeking to dramatize the events leading up to the Nazi takeover of Germany. And he had intentionally marginalized a group to illustrate the class dynamics whereby people would pile on. And he had done this before, and I was the first person in the history of the class to storm out and to tell him he was full of shit. So the moral of the story is, if you're feeling that sense of righteous indignation, be careful what you do, because you may end up doing the right thing. And you'll have to live up to it for the rest of your high school career.
This is Local Motion on KVNF. This week, stories told live from last week's North Fork Storytelling Series in Paonia. Our next storyteller is Russ Chapman. Russ is a musician and songwriter from Paonia.
When my son Leo was 9, he really, really wanted to play baseball, which meant one thing. It meant a trip to Napa Auto Parts. And once you're there, you do the proper thing. Okay, I got an 05 Pilot. I need a set of winter blades for that. I got a 2000 Outback. I need an oil filter, air filter. Oh, 2.4 liter V6. And then discreetly, you say, and my son would also like to sign up for Little League. If you've never done it, that's the way it's done around here. So we're done, and we're on our way to the great journey for Little League. And you know where the fields are. They're down there. And his coach was a rancher. Now, there was no more fitting background for a coach for a bunch of 9-year-old miscreants than a rancher. He had the ability, I watched him as he rustled the outliers from the outfield into the dugout, and he corralled them all together, and he gently prodded them until he properly branded them as a team. Now, baseball is not a complicated sport. It's pretty simple. You pitch the ball, you hit the ball, you run to the base, and you rinse and repeat. But to watch these kids at this first practice was like to watch a group of cats with socks on. And if you haven't seen the video, it's on the internet. It's just Google funny cats, and it'll come up. So this game was not instinctual for these kids. But at the very first actual real game, one kid stood out above the rest as being different. He was different because he was good. He was really good. He was scary good. He had a major league swagger. And he played catcher, but he played it like a conductor conducts an orchestra. And it was incredible to watch. And it was so much so that I nudged the guy next to me. I said, get a load of that catcher. He's something, isn't he? And this fellow's like, yeah, I guess. So we watched the game a little bit more, and this guy next to me says, what about your kid? Where's he at? I said, oh, he's out there in left field. I think he is, it looks like he's counting the flies that are accumulating underneath his hat. And I said, well, what about your kid? And he said, well, he's the catcher. That's Slater, and I'm Greg. And so that's when I met Greg. Now, Greg was a man who I just met, and that I had no idea that I'd become such close friends with, and someone who I had no idea would influence my life or have this indelible mark. Through an incredible grace and unbelievable guts. Now, baseball's similar to a lot of sports. There's a ball, there's a field, there's stands, but it's also different in a very significant way. And I didn't realize this until about the third game that baseball is missing something. There's no clock. Baseball essentially commandeers time, which is not a good thing for 9-year-olds. And so these games, they would just kind of drag on, and the pitchers could barely get the ball over the plate, and the batters they looked like mannequins from a sporting goods store, and the outfielders pretty much essentially looked like they had been drugged. And it was at that point in time I wished our rancher coach would go out to his truck, grab his cattle prod, and, you know, get things moving here. But alas, that never happened. So I took to grumbling, as I do, and I grumbled to Greg because we tended to sit together. First, I'd grumble about the weather, I'd grumble about the flies, or maybe a bad call on the field. But after a couple weeks, I started to grumble about the game itself, the game of baseball. Now, had I known at that point, or if my instincts would have told me that Greg loved baseball and the fact that he was a coach and was a player. I mean, I should have guessed by how good his son was. I may have held back, but you know, now that I think about it, I don't think I would have because I was bored. And so I started to grumble about the game. I said, you know, Greg, watch this kid. He's watched the first three pitches go by. They've all been balls. He's going to watch this next one go by. Oh, sure enough. And he's going to take his base. And I don't have a problem with that. I think that's fine. Baseball, they call it a walk. It's not a dash. It's not a sprint. Come on. Let's put some energy into this game. I don't get it. So I started ragging on baseball. I said, you know, and the other thing, too, is he's going to get to first, right? And let's say this kid's got a little extra initiative, right? And he wants to maybe go for second in between a couple pitches. Is he going to be rewarded for his effort? He's putting his ass on the line here. In baseball, they call it stealing. Greg, really, I don't get it. And like a patient batter watching an errant pitch, he just kind of let it all go by. I mean, he smiled, but he let it pass. And I wasn't going to give up. I said, you know, Greg, can you think of another sport where a team is named after socks? Seriously, two teams named after socks? It's truly uninspiring. He smirked a little bit, but he let that pitch go by too. So the game went on, and my brain all the time, I'm just churning and churning. What else do I got? What else do I got? So I finally said, Greg, you know that song, right? Take me out to the ball game. You know, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. Seriously, you don't care if you ever get back. You could stay here forever watching this. I really don't get baseball. And he still did not swing at that one. I was like, to myself, I said, okay, you know what? You need to send one right over the plate, one he's going to swing at. And so I leaned over. I said, Greg, you know, it's not even called a sport. They call it America's pastime. And that, of course, did it. And he swung with that one. And he actually nailed it out of the park because he replied to me. He said, you know what, Russ? If you're going to watch this whole season of these kids play, you're going to need to realize something. There's something you need. And I said, alcohol? And he said, no, not alcohol. But he did slide his coffee mug over, which just happened to be full of wine. And I said, oh, this is how you're doing it. This is how you're getting through all this. He said, no, maybe. But my point is you need a change in perspective. You need to look at the game a little differently. Because in this one big moment you're seeing, there's a lot of little moments within it. You need to stretch the whole thing out, slow it down, and realize this. And I said, okay, like for instance, and he showed me. He said, you're probably watching the pitcher right now, but what's happening while you're watching the pitcher is the shortstop. See him shifting a little bit towards second base? It's because the batter's a lefty. And the second baseman, he's shifting a little bit towards first, but not so much because there's a runner on first. And the catcher, well, look at him. He's up on his toes. He's getting ready for the throw. See, all these moments are happening within this one moment, and you just need to stretch it out. I said, okay, can I have some of that wine? So I took the rest of the season with this concept that I really held on to, that I really enjoyed, this idea of stretching things out. I said, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to stretch it out. But I couldn't do it. These kids were that bad. I could not find enough in the moment. But what I did do was I started bringing wine to the games. And that helped. That helped a lot. And you have to be discreet, but it does help. But this whole concept of stretching things out, I really took it to heart because I felt like I needed it in my life. I needed to be reminded of when I was doing something that I didn't really want to be doing, that I should be doing these other things that I want to be doing. So I did what some people do, and I don't know if any of you had, you put a rubber band around your wrist, and you kind of snap it, and you just kind of remind, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. Oh, you should be doing this. And it worked, and it was great. But I didn't really like the whole fashion statement with the rubber band around my wrist, so I put it in my pocket, and I just would bring it out once in a while and just kind of stretch it out, and I just would remember to just stretch out time. So over that course of that season, Greg and I became close friends, and I'd still prod him here and there about baseball, and he'd let me. He'd kind of encourage me. We had this rapport back and forth that was like a pitcher and a catcher, and I was throwing him these bad puns and these what I thought were witty insights, and he would catch them, and he'd throw them right back to me. It was, for me, my favorite pastime. And so the season progressed. And I remember one game in particular that I'll never forget. It just dragged on forever. It was like it was never going to end. And he nudges me. And he goes, Russ, you know the point of baseball, right? I said, no, I really don't. He said, it's to go home. It's like, yes, it is. And then I knew I had a special partner to go through this awful season with. So the season ended, and we stayed close friends. Our kids started to grow up, and they played other sports, and we worked together at the Pasta Project. And all the while, we had this flow, this great give and take. And I noticed one day that Greg had a limp. And it wasn't anything that looked serious. It looked like he had pulled a muscle in his leg. But I saw him again, and the limp was worse. And I said, you know, you should get that looked at. And what I didn't know at that point in time that he knew is that he had been diagnosed with ALS, which is a degenerative neural disease. It basically attacks your motor neurons and slowly and systematically takes away all your muscle functions. It's an awful, awful disease. And you might have heard of it as being called Lou Gehrig's disease. And Lou Gehrig, of course, was a baseball player. So when we all found out that Greg was diagnosed with ALS, we all wanted the same thing. We all hoped for the same thing. We hoped that maybe a treatment would come, or that it would stall, or maybe that it would slow down. But it didn't. It didn't stall, it didn't slow down, and there is no cure. So Greg faced this disease with an incredible, deep personal courage that kept him smiling, even as his body was wasting away, and a deep, unbelievable grace that kept everyone else around him from being too sad. Now, we all knew what was happening, and we all wanted the same thing. We all wanted more time. And so the gatherings became more frequent, and I knew why I watched him. I knew what he was doing. He was using his baseball zen and stretching out the moment. He was mustering everything he had to slow time down so he could bask in his friendships, he could smile and drink wine, and he could embrace his family. Greg was showing us all how to live. And you know, baseball has its own concept of time. But you know, maybe life does too. Maybe life doesn't really have a clock. Maybe we measure it by our special moments, by our friendships, by our loves and our family. Because after all, life, just like baseball, we're all headed home. And so as Greg's life, his physical life, started to fade, I started to sit with him on Mondays. And I was asked to come and to help. And it ended up being one of the best gifts I'd ever been given. And I remember sitting with him one of those last Mondays, and he was tired a lot by this point in time. And we'd look out in the mountains, and I'd maybe play the guitar a little bit, and we'd talk about our kids, and we would just sit. But we still had that flow. And I would sit, and I would watch him slowly close his eyes and fall asleep. And there we were, just the two of us, the pitcher and the catcher. And I remember I looked up at the mountains, and I looked at Greg. I took a deep breath and pulled that rubber band out of my pocket and just stretched it as far as I could. Thanks.
You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. This week, stories from the North Fork Storytelling Series, which was held last Wednesday at the Blue Sage in Paonia. Up next is Allie Lightfoot. Allie is the program director here at KVNF, where she trains DJs and oversees production of Local Motion and Talkin' Music.
Every summer until I was 13, I used to fly to Northern California to visit my grandparents. from Colorado, and they lived in the Redwoods outside of Mendocino, California, on this beautiful ranch. And my grandfather had this huge garden that had at least an acre of berries, all kinds of berries. There were blueberries and raspberries and strawberries, and I would just go down there in the morning and kind of pluck my breakfast. And one day when I was about six, my grandfather asked me if I would help him in the garden. And I said, absolutely. And he said, I want you to take a nail and a hammer and hammer all the banana slugs to the ground. And I was like, oh, right. And I thought that this sounded like a really exciting, you know, project. And I wanted to help him out. And I thought it was cool that he wanted me to protect the berries. And so I would do that every day. For hours, I would go down and nail banana slugs to the ground with a hammer. And I started to, I would search under logs, and I would, you know, I was really serious about this job. And I studied them, and I noticed that when I would put the nail in at a certain point, it would cause their guts to, like, come out this hole. And it would, the guts were, like, amazing. They were, like, this weird dark purple color, and there were other, like, things that would come out that were like neon green, and I really paid a lot of attention to them, and I kind of fell in love with them. Like, I love their little tentacle eyes, and I loved just how they could morph their whole bodies into different shapes. And it's kind of weird because really I was going on these, you know, slug killing sprees. But I enjoyed it at the time. And then when I was about 10, one summer, it, like, overnight for some reason, it hit me what I'd been doing. And I was filled with so much guilt and remorse. And I really, like, pictured them with families and, you know, lives and plans and everything. And I realized that they had the same plans that I did. They just wanted to go into this garden and eat berries. They weren't even really eating that many, you know. He had an acre of them. And it wasn't just slugs that I felt bad about. I had been picking up toads and squeezing them till they peed. And I was pulling the tails off of lizards. And it totally took me by surprise that I all of a sudden was just hit with all this kind of compassion and empathy that I still, like, get upset about it when I think about it today. And, you know, the only excuse I can make was that he asked me to do it and that I have a pretty strong work ethic. So if somebody, like, tells me to do something, I'll be like, all right, let's do it. And also, I was really intrigued by their anatomy and curious about them. And that, I think about that, and it reminds me that we do a lot of strange things because just somebody asks us to, or because we're curious. And I think that empathy and sympathy kind of wait dormant, and they come out in unexpected, it comes out in an unexpected way. And I noticed that my son is the same way. He also loves slugs. And he used to go collect them in our yard, handfuls of little ones, and hand them to me like they were just the most beautiful treasure. And one time he put some in his pocket, and then I did the wash. And so we both, like, were devastated because we drowned this whole handful of slugs. And then recently what he likes to do is trap animals so that he can look at them. So he traps them. He trapped a skunk and a rabbit, and the skunk posed some problems when it was time to let it go. But he trapped a squirrel that rammed its head against the cage all night until it died recently. So he asked me to put the trap away until summer.
Our last storyteller is Dev Carey. Dev is the district manager at Delta Conservation District, but his real passion is for education and adventures. He lives on a mesa outside Paonia.
Part one. I dated a woman once whose brother was on death row. And we went to visit him there. And we showed up, went through all the security, and went into the room, and I sat down, and there was John, that was his name, and I introduced myself. And we started to talk. And as you, it was an awkward conversation, as you might expect when you're meeting your girlfriend's brother for the first time. And it was more awkward because there was this big piece of plexiglass in between us with two-way speakers and cameras coming down from both sides and guards right behind, carefully listening. And it was more awkward still because John had on these prison blues and handcuffs and leg shackles. And probably what made it the most awkward was that he'd been in solitary confinement for over a year. So there really wasn't much to talk about. But we talked about who the Suns had drafted. We talked about how his parents were doing. And the whole time we talked, I was looking at him, trying to figure out how he was different than me. Because I was normal. And he was a murderer. And he wasn't just an ordinary murderer. He was one of those kind of murderers that goes way above and beyond and beats somebody to the point of oblivion. And you read probably sometime in the papers how somebody knifes somebody 67 times or something, and you're like, what kind of crazy person could do that? And he'd beaten an old couple to death after they'd caught him stealing their car. And he'd, the authorities described the scene as one full of lots of gore and guts. And I couldn't find that thing that made him different. The conversation was pretty normal, actually. And as we were walking out, we talked for exactly half an hour. And then as we walked out, I thought, well, maybe what makes him different is he's just the kind of person who cracks and becomes somebody else under extreme pressure. And he becomes a murderer then. But otherwise, he's kind of normal. And indeed, to listen to John tell it, he just wanted to steal the car, and then he'd been discovered and had kind of defended himself, and then something had snapped, and he didn't remember anything after that. I was glad he was different than me. Part two. I'm walking up on one of these high mesas up above town. It's really early morning. The sun's just coming up. I'm walking a fence line. And as I walk along, I see up in the distance a couple coyotes and a raven. And the raven flies up and the coyotes run off as I approach. And I look to see what's there. And as I get closer, I can see that there's a deer there. And it's lying caught in the fence. And I get closer still and I see that one of its hind legs is in between the barbed wire, which is all twisted around, and it's caught there. And I get closer still and I see that the coyotes had gotten there first, and its stomach was ripped open and its guts were scattered around in the dirt, and the white and the red was all mixed with the brown of the dirt. And I got up closer to look, and all of a sudden the deer started kicking in fear and looking at me with these terrified eyes. And I just felt this compassion for this hurt animal. And I grew up around animals, and the adults around me had kind of said, well, the thing to do in this situation, when there's a hurt animal that's probably going to die anyway, is put it out of its misery. That's the kind thing to do. So I fell to my pocket for a knife, and I didn't have one. And I looked around. I couldn't think of any way to help this deer out. And then in a moment of naivete, I thought, well, it's pretty weak already. Maybe I'll just strangle it. And so I got down on my knees and put my hands around the deer's neck, found the trachea and got everything all ready and squeezed. And the deer started making these deep breaths. And it was terrifying. And I squeezed harder with everything I had. And still it was breathing like that. And I could feel the air going through the trachea. And it wasn't working, and that deer was suffering even more. And in a moment of panic, I dug a hole right beside its head, and I stuck its nose and mouth down in there and buried it and thought maybe that will keep it from breathing. And still it breathed, and you could see the dust going into the hole. And I panicked even more, and I grabbed one of those big pieces of basalt that's up there on the mesas with the little air pockets in there, and bashed it on the head, and it kicked and jerked all over and still didn't die, and I bashed again and again and again and again. And finally, it lay still, and its head was just a pulp. And in the quiet moment afterwards, I had a moment of reflection and realized that maybe I really wasn't that different than John. And that in that kind of moment, in that kind of life or death, panicky, high stress moment, maybe I too was capable of beating beyond recognition some innocent being, just hoping that it would die fast. Part three. I'm at home with my baby girl, Soraya. She's about 1.5. And she was crying, like she often did. And I tried everything I knew how to do. I'd been really mellow and tried to get her to go to sleep. I'd distracted her. I'd read her books. I'd let her take the hat off my head and put it on again and drop it on the floor. And still, she was crying. I changed her diaper. I gave her food. And I was getting this feeling in my own gut after a while of frustration and anger and just kind of like, stop crying, please. But I was holding on, and I knew from practice not to show that feeling or it would just make her cry more. So I tried to just stuff it and smile and hold out. And her mom, Marilee, was due to come home at 2:00, and I figured I could hold out till then. So 2:00 came, and Marilee wasn't there, and that pit in my stomach got a little bigger, and I tried other things and waited, and she cried and cried and screamed and screamed, and a crying baby is enough of a challenge, but when you feel like it's your fault and you can't do anything and you're helpless and it's your own kid, sometimes it's even worse. And finally at 2:15, a while later, she said, "I want mama." She was just starting to talk, which just reaffirmed my sense of inadequacy and being a horrible dad. And I said, "Yeah, I do too." And I put her down on the bed a little harder than was necessary. And she stopped crying and looked at me with this horror in her eyes of, oh my gosh, here's this safe guy who maybe could hurt me. My dad. It was a horrible feeling, and all of a sudden I realized, well, finally Marilee came home and it all ended well and nobody got hurt. But I realized that feeling that I'd had in the gut was the same that I'd had when I was stoning that deer, and that maybe it wasn't only in life and death situations, but maybe it was something that I'd been in denial about that was actually kind of frequent in my life and affected me in a way I didn't like, and maybe I needed to find a different option. Part four. I'm driving on one of these high mountain passes, and it's lunchtime, and it's a beautiful day, and it's sunny, and the aspen leaves are green, and there's these little white clouds floating above, I remember that there's this little dirt road where you could turn off and drive up there. And there's a big piece of granite with all this nice little lichen you could sit on. And you could sit there and eat lunch. And down below was this little glen with a little trickle of a spring and a place where there were those yellow monkey flowers. And I'd seen a weasel there once bouncing up and down in the cornhusk lily. And I thought, I'm going to go have lunch there. And so I turned my car off that road and noticed right away that it was more traveled than I'd seen before. And I drove up the mile to the end of the road, and there was where the granite rock had used to be where I'd sat, there was now a parking lot. And in the parking lot were 3 or 4 white pickup trucks that said things about energy and gas and things on the door. And there was a really big truck in there with a big trailer. And I took them all in, but quickly my attention switched down to the glen where there was a bulldozer that was busy toppling a few aspen trees right down there in that place that I'd watched. And I parked the car and turned it off, and right away I felt that feeling in my gut again of this anger mixed with sadness, mixed with frustration. And I thought of all the things I could do, and I thought about jumping out and slashing, this time I had a knife, slashing the tires of all those white pickup trucks because nobody was around. They were all down there in the glen. And I thought about running down in front of the bulldozer and tying myself to a tree or something. And somehow it just didn't quite seem right. And as I was getting worked up there and feeling it all, I happened to remember that I was interested in finding another option to this feeling in my gut. And so I took a deep breath and kind of lengthened the back of my neck and sat back and decided to look around and see what else I could see. And I saw a nut hatch going head first down a spruce tree, and I opened my window a little bit so I could hear its sound because I love that. And I noticed that the trees, when they fell, would quake and shiver just like in a big storm, and that their roots, when they came up, were just these beautiful things, and the color when they broke off. And I noticed that the guy driving the bulldozer looked like a nice guy, actually. He had a little white goatee. And I noticed there was a golden mantle squirrel that was coming out from the pickup trucks and was eating another dead squash squirrel that was lying there. And as I sat there, I noticed that the feeling in my gut was getting a little less. And it occurred to me that maybe I could have sat beside that deer and just sat with it, and then maybe let our guts melt together and mine let the fear go away and it's melt into the dirt with death. And it felt better. And I ate my lunch. And I drove away. And as I drove away, there was this realization that I'd felt that fear in my gut, and I'd done absolutely nothing. And somehow it felt like a thing to celebrate. It felt like doing nothing had taken a lot of guts. Thank you.
You've been listening to select stories from the North Fork Storytelling Series on Local Motion at KVNF. Stay tuned for One Woman's Perspective coming up next. For KVNF, I'm Emily Guerin.